Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin. Happy New Year. It's January 2. Appreciate you joining us on the podcast today. A little later, John Roerink and I are going to be interviewing Governor Rick Snyder. It will be part two of our year-end interview with the governor, which he will be talking about OPEB, otherwise known as retiree health care for local units of government, and what he would do about a FOIA bill. If a bill were to land on his desk that would expand the Freedom of Information Act law to the governor's office, is that something that he would sign? We'll listen to the governor's answer to this and other questions in the second half of this podcast. But first, looking ahead to the year 2017 and 10 subjects that are likely to be popping up in the year 2017. Obviously, we've heard about the skilled trades expansion that is of interest to the governor and incoming Speaker Tom Leonard, mental health and keeping the mentally ill out of prison. But these are subjects that would seem to be somewhat uncontroversial. Maybe the details would need to be worked out between Republicans and Democrats, but by and large should not be a controversial issue, either one of them. Let's go through some things that may be a little more sticky for lawmakers to have to deal with. We're going to start with the incoming president, Donald Trump. What is he going to do with Obamacare? And in particular, what is that going to mean for the state's Healthy Michigan program? As we know, Healthy Michigan was created 3 years ago and is an expansion of Medicaid to cover folks who are between 100 and 133% of the poverty line. Over 600,000 people are now receiving their health care through Medicaid expansion. And what is going to happen if Donald Trump gets into office and with a Republican Congress decides to scrap Obamacare? What is that going to do for the state's liability? And will the state be allowed to continue the program? If so, how much federal government help is going to be necessary? The current Healthy Michigan program is structured in such a way that the state picks up a substantial cost starting this year, but it receives additional savings through mental health and corrections and other items in the budget. So as it stands now, Michigan is actually saving money through the Healthy Michigan program in general. But if Trump goes in there with Congress and starts restructuring things, what is that going to mean for the program? What is that going to mean to the state budget? And more importantly, what does this mean for the 600,000 people who are on the program? That's going to be one of the top things that they're going to have to be keeping an eye on this year. Number two, at the end of last year, we saw Rick Snyder float a proposal through the Senate that would require that income tax revenue that is received for the school aid fund or that is earmarked for the school aid fund would have to have refunds that are due back to individuals because of the income tax refunded out of the school aid fund. So this sounds complicated, but it is not. Let's take a look at money coming into the state from the income tax. Right now, those refunds that we receive back when we fill out our income tax, if you're lucky enough to get a refund, all comes out of the general fund. Snyder says that's not fair. The money that is also coming in from income tax revenue that is directed at school aid fund should have to equally spend out money back to people who paid income tax and are due refunds. What does that mean, though? Well, it means the school aid fund would be short $446 million every year. That's obviously something that isn't very popular among Democrats and would not be very popular among many Republicans as well, unless it can be adequately explained to people that this is just not taking money out of the school aid fund. The problem, though, for the governor as he looks ahead is that the general fund is going to be very stressed. We mentioned the Healthy Michigan program, but we're looking more to what's going to happen with road funding going into the future. The governor claims that the general fund situation is good. However, I have a hard time believing that this subject will not come up in his 2018 budget presentation in February. The Senate was not all that excited and lame duck to move forward on something that can be easily framed as taking money out of the school aid fund. MPSRS reform, the teacher retirement program. The Senate had tried to get rid of teacher pensions at the end of 2016. They may try that again in 2017, but I don't see that as being a burning issue because the governor doesn't like that idea. He's very much impressed with what has happened with the hybrid system that was set up for teacher retirement, where there is a type of pension system that is offered to retiring teachers or new hires. And I have a hard time believing he's going to back off of this creation that he seems to support, and so does his Office of Retirement Services. I do see, however, the governor and the legislature having an in-depth discussion and a continued discussion on local government employee retirement health care. This was a subject that was started off in the House last year. Didn't get a lot of movement. We got some transparency legislation through, but I see more of a tiered system creation coming out of the year 217. I see something like if you're a local unit of government and your post-retirement benefits, which is known as OPEB, other post-employment benefits, if your OPEB costs are funded at, let's say, 85, 90, 100%, then this legislation would not impact you at all. But if you are between 60 and 80% funded, let's say, there are certain restrictions on what you can offer. And if you're going to offer them, you have to do X, Y, and Z. Same thing if you are 60% and under, there would be more requirements on your system. If you're going to offer your future employees or even your current employees post-retirement benefits until they get to age 65, until they qualify for Medicare, then you have to do some cost-sharing programs, kind of like this 80-20 program that we saw at the school level, where the employer will cover 80% of the costs, but the employee has to cover 20% of the costs. I see something like that happening in 2017 to address these looming costs that could put some significant pressure on cities across our state. So put OPEB on number three on the list for issues to address in the year 2017. Number four on my list is, what are the Republicans going to do about Flint? Senator Jim Stomas put together a report late last year that addressed the lead poisoning in Flint with about 30 to 40 recommendations, legislative recommendations, very few of which got any attention in the closing months of 2016. I see 2017 being a little different. Whether it has to do with changing the current emergency manager system to a three-person panel or doing some other kind of drastic changes to how emergency manager or state oversight is conducted when you see local governments or school districts under distress, something will happen here. The last thing this Republican legislature wants to do is continue to let Flint linger as an issue that Dan Kildee could campaign for governor on in 2018. Flint played little role, I'll give you, in the 2016 election in which Donald Trump won Michigan, first Republican since 88. However, 2018 will be much different because the attention will be on state issues. And as so much as Republicans can neutralize Flint as a campaign issue by addressing whatever came out of that report, working with Democrats, and as much as humanly possible, taking that off the table, I think they would go ahead and do something like that. It's always possible that in 2 years, Dan Kildee, in his run for governor, which is a presumed reality at this point, would bring up Flint repeatedly. And if the Republicans do nothing, that would give him a message that would resonate very well in various parts of the state, including those areas that have been touched by emergency managers, Detroit, Flint, and other urban areas throughout the state. And that may encourage people to go to the polls, unlike this last presidential campaign, where a surprising number of urban voters decided to take a pass on the election. Number five, auto insurance reform. I see this coming up again. Whether it passes or not, I think, is always the question. But with the Senate not changing over at all, and the Senate being receptive to some type of auto insurance reform in 2015 and 16, I see Tom Leonard, the new Speaker of the House, testing out the issue with his new caucus and this new legislature. Is there some common ground that can be reached with Sam Singh, the new minority leader? Tim Grimmel was unwilling to compromise on this issue at all, but is there some common ground that this new Democratic caucus would find agreeable that would at least put this issue off and not have it become a perennial issue? Also, we got to remember Mike Duggan is going to be up for re-election, presuming he does run for re-election in 2017. Would it make sense to get through his D-insurance program that he put on the table or some other program that would try and neutralize these insurance costs in the city of Detroit, these crippling auto insurance costs in the city of Detroit? That could give Mike Duggan a chance to have another significant win with this legislature and might make him happy enough to want to stay as the mayor of Detroit and not entertain any discussion about running for governor in 2018. Also in 2017, this TIF on steroids issue that was brought up in 2016, I see coming back and maybe in a smaller form. This is this program where significant transformational projects within urban cores would be allowed to collect the income and sales tax that would otherwise be paid off to the state and keep it within the project itself to help supplement the new income for what would be a very expensive venture. This has very much been put in the focus because of Dan Gilbert's plans for the Hudson Building or the Wayne County Jail property. This is something that the House was not interested in pursuing in 2016, but if it was limited to a much smaller scope than what has been originally put out there, instead of five transformational projects, maybe two, maybe only one, maybe the dollar figure is brought back down. However it's structured, I see the House being more open to this idea in the 2017-18 session than they were in the 15-16 session. Also, long-term infrastructure, number 7. I believe the governor will continue to beat the drum on long-term infrastructure reform, whether it's the water, underground sewer. It's a non-sexy issue that may very well just get kicked into 2018 as far as action, barring more sinkholes or lead poisoning or what have you. But I think this is a drip-drip issue that will continue through the year. Again, no action may happen this year necessarily on this, but I do think that this is going to be a continued discussion as we talk about long-term infrastructure costs in this state and the needs to address a problem like what happened in the city of Flint. However, time will tell whether the public is willing to fork over additional money to fix their pipes underground. And then number 8, juvenile justice. How do you handle 17-year-olds being tried as adults? Should that be banned as the House passed legislation that would end the practice of 17-year-olds being tried and sentenced as adults? The concern obviously is at the county level. If you don't put them in a state prison, that means they're in a county facility. And do the counties have the money then to handle these 16, 17, 15-year-olds? Senator Rick Jones, the Senate Judiciary Committee chair, said he's interested in looking in this subject in the coming term. He's not interested in looking at presumptive parole, which was passed last year. So that may be a 2019-2020 discussion, depending on how the Senate elections go. But presumptive parole, doubt that's going to happen this term. Juvenile justice, keep an eye on that in 2017. And then number 9, the governor's private-public partnerships legislation. The House was not interested in moving that bill in 2016, was concerned that the governor's idea of bringing in the private sector to help build roads, transit systems, healthcare buildings, labs, as 33 other states do, could open the door to toll roads. I think if they are convinced and the bill is written in such a way that it is crystal clear that privately run toll roads would not happen in the state of Michigan, I see this bill passing fairly easily and without much controversy. And then the last thing, dark stores. This has to do with these big box stores and how they are assessed by their local assessor and whether Representative Dave Maturin out of Marshall was big in pushing through legislation in the House last term that would realign the assessment of these box stores so they are assessed by their current value as opposed to what their value would be if they were shut down and empty. Obviously, the Chamber of Commerce, the retailers were not very happy with what came out of the House. The Senate, in turn, decided not to do anything with it. But this is an issue that continues to impact governments and local governments throughout the state. This bill will come back up and may very well again pass through the House. Additional pressure may be put on the Senate. If this is something that happens this year, I think it's still pretty 50-50. Well, it will happen in 2019-20. The odds are a little better at that point. But either way, I don't see the issue of dark stores going away anytime soon. Those are our top 10 issues of things to look out for the year 2017. Now, as promised, our publisher, John Rurink, and myself were able to sit down with the governor a couple weeks ago to talk about OPEB, FOIA, and other issues. Listen in on that conversation.
As the head of the automotive space, we've got a lot of automotive suppliers, we've got a healthy ag industry that exports. Talk from Trump about possible tariffs. Give us your reaction to that and concerns you have.
Yeah, what I'd say is the tariff thing would be premature to comment because you don't know what that means because it's on what and how does it, what happens, what's the response. My concern in the broadest sense would be, is I appreciate him looking at the questions. I think it's a fair question to say Did we always get the appropriate arrangements with other countries? And if we didn't, we should be working on that. Beyond that, I have a concern if we got into a trade war in a more general sense, because a trade war probably would not be a great outcome for any of the participants in that in terms of their own economic well-being. We were coming back in a macroeconomic sense in the U.S. The rates were relatively slow for national growth. Michigan's been doing better than the rest of the nation for several years now. And a trade war could actually create a situation where you can see that growth slow or reverse for some time period.
Given his rhetoric, do you see us going down that path? I mean, is his rhetoric leading us there?
No, I would always separate. You had a campaign, now you're governing. And the normal history of things say you tend to get, and this is true of almost any candidate. I think I'm one of the relatively exceptions to the rule, but most people's campaign rhetoric tends to be kind of more to the extreme or more accentuated than once they govern. It tends to get moderated some, either by themselves or by the fact they recognize they have a legislature or other pressures on them.
Talk about the present agendas and block granting of Medicaid. What kind of risks and opportunities do you think that presents?
Yeah, I actually answered that question several years ago. I went and testified before Congress. I did it with a Democratic governor, and it was to the Workforce Committee. Because we need to reform how workforce dollars get distributed. They're in 40-some federal programs. They slice and dice people. It's not the appropriate way to do that. And so I told them, I'm going to give you an answer that there's a stereotype you'd expect to hear. A Democratic governor, you'd expect him to come in and say, give me another prescriptive program, give me more money in this category. Said a Republican governor would come in and say, just write me a check, give me a block grant. Mm-hmm. I don't believe either answer is necessarily the right answer. And I wouldn't necessarily do that if I was in their spot, and I don't do it here in Michigan very often. What I'd say is do it in a more block grant form, but hold me accountable for outcomes. So don't tell me how to do it. Don't tell me what inputs I have. Don't tell me what outputs I have, but tell me what outcomes I need to get to in terms of showing results for that.
So you don't want a blank check.
How many cases in my budgets have you seen me sort of put performance metrics or measures to say, it's not about just giving you money, you have to, you know, show some sort of performance and accountability? I think that's a fair question to ask, particularly if you say, we're going to give you a lot of flexibility on what you do. That allows for innovation. The reason I like that format is I have always believed, as you get to lower levels, quite often they're closer to the issue, so hopefully they have a better understanding of how best to solve the issue. And then you try to do best practices so you can compare notes. That's the laboratories of democracy, what we do with the states. But I think we should be held accountable for outcomes.
Local units of government have an obligation to provide new hires with retirement health care benefits.
Technically, they don't have to. I mean, that's true of any employment. What I would say is there's a tradition of doing that. And I think most people would want to continue to do that. That's one of the features of how you attract good employees. Going back to the more tangible sense here is I think the discussion here probably was a challenged discussion in many respects. I think the positive that came out of it is they sort of teed up the issue. There wasn't the appropriate time frame to really address it the way it needs to be done. And so what I've told people is I plan on putting together a task force of people on a very broad base. Not too many people, but representing a broad cross-section, including an element from labor, to say, this is a serious issue, and can we set something up that would go through, you know, wrap up before the first half of the year ends, to say, let's look at local post-retiree medical and pension issues, and understand there's an issue, but let's have people at the table hashing through the issues, because I want people, if they have benefits, to be able to get those benefits, and that's one of the challenges we have today.
Because how real is that possibility that a local unit of government will have to renege on those retiree health care benefits?
Well, again, that's a whole set of different legal issues. There's not one answer. Because if you look at the way to approach it, in my view, is you almost have to, and I don't want to sound too technical, but it's almost building a matrix of different layers of this and then breaking it down. And actually, it's the spreadsheet in me. I actually did an outline already that I sent out to some of the people to start to put this together to say, I'll give you a couple of illustrations. So first, let's go get the data on jurisdictions and ask the question, who's well-funded? And there are some very well-funded that we probably don't even need to do anything with. Mm-hmm. There are some very poorly funded ones that are a serious problem. And it's hard to say, how are they going to get out of this hole? without us being extremely creative or working together. And then there's a lot in the middle, and sort of break it down that way. And then the next question is how do you deal with existing retirees? How do you deal with new hires? And then on the active, it's almost, I think you might have to split that into two groups. One, those that have been there so long that are nearing retirement versus other ones that have been there fewer years that may have accrued something, but you can say you're going to be there enough following years where you may qualify if it was relevant to get you in Social Security or Medicare. Does that make sense to you?
Kind of layer it here.
There's all these, and there's about four or five different groups. They tend to fall into groups of three or four, but there's like four or five groups of these three or four that I think really help break it down into bite-sized chunks, because just to come up and say we got a problem or the number's X billion dollars doesn't help solve it in a thoughtful fashion. Again, I think that's one of the skill sets I do bring to the table, is to say, how do we break this down into more understandable, manageable pieces, recognizing we're talking about people? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Turning to MIPSRS, director of the Office of Retirement Assistance told the Senate Appropriations Committee she wants to lower the rate of return expectations from 8 to 7, I mentioned a second. Are there other changes you've been thinking about to make that maybe are easier to achieve, smaller than perhaps what the Senate attempted to stabilize that system?
MIPSRS is a system that we made some huge improvements a few years ago. Going to the hybrid system was a huge improvement. So generally, if you go to the look forward, you still have the historical legacy question. In that, you have this rate of return question, and that's one of the questions that can create pressures on all the funds, depending on where those dollars are, because it's not just MIPSRS. About, it would make sense to potentially gradually bring down the rate of return. It's not flipping a light switch, though, where you all of a sudden you jump from one to the other, but how do you work towards that? I'm always proud of the fact that longer term, when we did this plan a few years ago, this could change how much is required, but we're actually trying to say, how do we get it all funded by 2038? I do this every budget presentation. It's my favorite slide. No one pays very much attention. You guys pay more attention than most people. But if you start looking at that slide, you can see if we stuck to that payment plan, what positive implications it has for the future of the state. You got to wait to 2038, but the number being freed up is literally in the billions of dollars a year. One of the things when we get to this infrastructure question and some of these other questions, and I appreciate your question about shorter term pressures, Cal, one of the things I'm trying to collect is what's the roll off of a bunch of historical legacy stuff and how that could be used as a potential funding mechanism to deal with some of these longer term issues that we didn't functionally address, either education or infrastructure or something. And there's a bunch of them. I mean, think about the mega retention credits. Okay. They run through 2028 through 2030, roughly.
Yeah.
But you're talking hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Think about what we just did with Detroit Public Schools. That was $70 to $72 million a year for 7 or 8 years. But after 7 or 8 years, it frees that much up. So there's a whole list of these things that are sort of legacy things that the average public official does not spend a lot of time saying how we can leverage these things to be important positive attributes for our state. I think there is a huge value being the token CPA governor, that I'm looking at this over this much longer term horizon, because I feel reasonably comfortable over the next couple of years we can do some pretty good budgets, you know, barring major trade wars or other things. Mm-hmm. But if I can figure out a longer term roadmap to give to people to say, here are some really smart things that we can do that require some discipline to understand and communicate what they are. And then if people develop a plan, not just me, but we develop a plan on how to use them, how much farther ahead can we be? Mm-hmm. And how can we avoid doing more of those things that some of them weren't very bright? Some of them were very good policy, like the Detroit debt thing. Mega retention credits, that was nuts in some ways. In terms of it, could have been done a much better way. And I don't criticize the companies for that, because they were working in good faith.
One last question, if we could here. Quick one, yes or no. Do you support expanding FOIA to the governor's office?
I understand the concept, but there are challenges to that.
Okay.
And it really comes back to the question about how do we brainstorm and how do we come up with ideas to make sure I can have an open dialogue with my team? I think it's a fair question to ask.
Well, just have emails that we can FOIA later and write news stories on.
Right.
Well, again, think about
Just give us access to your email server, like, you know.
Well, I largely did.
You could call us Cozy Murders or Fancy Murders.
But what happens then is then you just have more meetings and people talking about versus figuring out here's the best way to have a lot of dialogue and brainstorm. And I don't want to discourage brainstorming. Mm-hmm. So I'm always open to say if people can, how do we strike that balance? So I don't say a hard no to the answer, but it's like, can we have a discussion about how do you create that? How do you create that environment for innovation while you're still making sure when you decide something, yeah, it's available.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks for joining us. Special thanks to our sponsor, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all of our podcasts, the boss, John Roerink, and the folks over at the governor's office for setting up our year-end interview. Appreciate you joining us. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.